where we've come from. We started off thinking about William Blake and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, mostly focusing on Blake. And Blake gave us, if you remember, a kind of inner route map for our different imaginative states of mind. If you remember his names of Ulro, which is a very rational mind, generation concerned with reproduction but slipping into replication, Beulah, which is concerned with love but can also morph into hate unless you have access to his fourth state, which he called Eden or Eternity, which is his transcendent state, both enabling us to transcend ourselves, and particularly ourselves in those earlier states of mind, but also giving us the fullest access to the divine through the use of the imagination. That's his fourfold vision, as opposed to the one, two, and threefold visions of the earlier states. And then through Coleridge, who was a near contemporary of Blake, we had the famous remark about how the imagination is actually sharing in the divine imagination, the divine creativity, and that when our imagination produces things that last and that are productive, we're sharing in the divine mind, as opposed to when they're just fantastical and fun. Sort of nothing wrong with that per se, but a very different quality of imagination, which Coleridge just called fantasy. So that was our sort of starting off point with those two huge figures. And then last week we talked about Carl Jung. And in a way, I think the key thing that Carl Jung brings, again, taking the imagination absolutely seriously, it's the central human faculty for Jung as well. But particularly being a psychotherapist, it's about understanding our own inner lives. And then once we gain a certain understanding of that in all their complexity, then we can perhaps start to perceive the more objective aspects of the psyche. So Jung gives us a lot of tools, and the things that have happened since Jung's time have developed those tools even further to understand and discern. And so not just trust the imagination unthinkingly, unknowingly, but to be able to develop it and run with it. And particular sense this edge where our own insights about ourselves start to show through insights maybe about the cosmos around us, maybe about the divine as well, that crucial process. You might say that Jung, I think, remakes the spiritual journey, which say monks and nuns and spiritual adepts of previous eras would have gone about in different ways. And this evening I want to come to Owen Barfield, because what Barfield gives us, I think, is a kind of big story for the imagination. He too realized that it's the absolutely crucial human faculty. But what he also gave us is the overarching picture of why and where the imagination might take us. And to cut to the chase, I think you can summarize what he came to realize by saying that it's not that we have imagination as if it's something that our brains or our lives give us in isolation, and that if we're lucky, help us to inject some meaning into an otherwise meaningless cosmos. He saw it actually exactly the other way around. He thought that the imagination has us, and that when we exercise and enjoy and pursue our imaginative lives, we're coupling to that wider interiority. So as he put it in a very beautiful remark, I think, our inner lives can connect with the inside of the whole world. That's what our imagination enables us to do, to link in with the divine imagination. So he's very much in this Coleridgean tradition, and indeed wrote a book about Coleridge, very clearly recognizing that. He was also very influenced in his thought by Rudolf Steiner, the esotericist and founder of Anthroposophy. And whilst I'm not going to say anything very explicit about Steiner this evening, if any of you know anything about Steiner, you'll probably hear the echoes of the way that Steiner would put things. He has his own language and his own way of putting things. But certainly when Barfield had recognized the centrality of the imagination in human life, he then discovered the writings of Rudolf Steiner and even heard him talk once. And I think gained great sort of succor from that and realized that Steiner in his own way had developed and taken things enormously far as well. And so became a great influence upon him. And then the third group I just wanted to mention that Owen Barfield influenced as well as being influenced by were the Inklings. So this was the group that most famously included C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And they're interesting in their own way because in some ways C.S. Lewis was, well, Barfield called him, or they called each other, their oppositional friends. They argued and fought and worried and collaborated, trying to work out the full extent of the imagination. And broadly speaking, Owen Barfield was on the side of the imagination being a primary, if not the primary, human faculty. Whereas C.S. Lewis was more inclined to think that reason was more important and it could be illuminated by imagination. So they were close, but they had their differences. Whereas I think J.R.R. Tolkien was much more on Barfield's side. He really trusted the imagination. And in his great work, The Lord of the Rings, thought that he was engaging in the divine imagination, which he called sub-creation. And so I think that's why The Lord of the Rings feels like a complete cosmos unto itself. Whereas C.S. Lewis, you're always, nearly always anyway, aware that he's using his very powerful imagination, but to illuminate things that in a way he has trusted by other means, and in particular by his reason and by his faith. So those three points, I hope, give you some sense of Owen Barfield and where he's coming in. He lived for a large, large part of the 20th century, born in 1898, died in 1997. And said he had one big idea, which was to do with the imagination. He discovered it because he was a philologist. He worried and wondered a lot about the way that words work and how words change their meaning over the course of the centuries. And realizing that words have an inner life themselves, a kind of soul that communicates to us. So with luck, when you hear me speaking, you don't hear random noises, you do hear words, and moreover, you hear words that carry some meaning and maybe even take you into different worlds. And that's because words have soul, and that's because they engage the human imagination and bring that interiority to life and guide it and forge it and shape it. That's how he came to his realization about the imagination, and then developed it further. Now, he has this story for the imagination, and it works, I think, at least at two interlocking levels. And so I thought I could say something about that now. The first level, actually, I've talked about before in a previous Finchley Trust talk, but just to rehearse it again now, Barfield studied texts because he was so interested in words. And in particular, he studied text over the last 3,000 or so years, because it's roughly over that time that we have sophisticated texts in myths, particularly. So reaching back to the earliest parts of the Hebrew Bible, Homer, those texts around the Mediterranean particularly interested him. And he realized that if you look at those texts, you can track shifts of consciousness, what he called an evolution of consciousness. And in particular, he thought that the very earliest parts of those texts show human beings having what he called original participation. So that means that they shared in the life of others, the cosmos, the gods, the world around them, in an immersive way. They, as it were, didn't have to wrestle with whether there's meaning. They knew that there was meaning, and the great challenge was how to navigate that meaning, which kind of flooded into them from the outside in. And they tended not to talk about the imagination in the way that we do, as I've said before, actually. Imagination was much more a theory of optics back then, how we receive the imago and so see. Rather, they talked about inspiration. And so, for example, if you read Plato on poetry, he will tell you that the muse inspires you, and poets would call on the muses to speak to them, to channel poetry and words and insights and myths. So that was the experience of original participation. Barfield realized that we go through phases of alienation, where that participation withdraws, as he puts it. And in fact, that's why we think of figures like Plato and Socrates as so key, and others like Jesus, maybe in other axial figures too, like the Buddha, you could say, and Lao Tzu in the Taoist tradition. And they become so significant for us because they are the kind of original wrestlers with this experience of being, to some degree or other, cut off from this spontaneous immersion, this spontaneous inspiration, and the trouble that causes, the questions of meaning it raises. But it has an upside. It always has an upside for Barfield, because what it does is it intensifies our sense of individuality. And with figures like Socrates, with figures like later Judaism and Christianity, the sense of being an individual as we know it now starts to emerge. That consciousness starts to emerge. And the task subtly shifts to regaining participation by processes that Barfield called reciprocal participation or final participation, where we much more consciously and self-consciously regain a sense of being part of the cosmic imagination, of the divine life. And that return has the great advantage that we know ourselves as individuals sharing in the divine life. And so things like incarnation become possible in the Christian sense, that individuals can know themselves as humans, but also as fully transparent to the divine, the way archetypically set by Jesus. So that's Barfield's kind of story in almost historical time, beginning at the edges of prehistory into historical time. But he also has a cosmic story, which is more at the edges of his thought and does borrow on other figures, like particularly the Neoplatonists, Rudolf Steiner and others. But I wanted to put it together for you in this way, because in a way it's the biggest story that I know, where the imagination plays this key role of powering, enabling the perception of this biggest story. And I'm going to shift here to try and share a couple of slides to show this. So let me get this up. Now, I hope that you can see a new slide. Could someone give me a thumbs up just to say that you can see that? Thanks very much. So this is maybe a familiar picture, actually. This is one of the ways that modern physicists and cosmologists in particular represent the story of the cosmos from the Big Bang. And the part of the diagram that I want to draw attention to this evening is the phase changes in this story. So it starts right on the left-hand side there, where it says quantum fluctuations, with the cosmos emerging out of nothing. Now, there's some debate about this nothingness. I mean, actually, in this diagram, it says quantum fluctuations, which suggests there's a quantum field before the Big Bang, out of which the Big Bang emerges. But anyway, it comes out of a point of infinite density and infinite smallness, our cosmos emerges. And as it expands very quickly to start with that period of inflation there, it goes through various phase changes where gradually details of the material world, as modern physics has revealed them, start to emerge. So first of all, you get particles emerge. So this is subatomic particles like electrons and photons, and the afterglow of the Big Bang starts to stabilize and be possible to be seen. Then you get atoms. These start to form dust clouds, which gives to a new phenomenon in the cosmos of galaxies, vast, vast dust clouds. And then within those dust clouds start to coalesce and form stars. And that enables particular nuclear fusion to take place, where the very primitive atoms and particles of the early cosmos start to be able to form more complex atoms and particles. And you might well have heard that the carbon in our bodies, for example, was formed in the nuclear reactions of these stars. So carbon is quite a complex atom compared to, say, a hydrogen atom, and certainly compared to an electron or a photon. So that's another phase change with stars. And then you get planets that form around these stars as well. We're kind of maybe about a third of the way along this funnel. And with planets starts to emerge the possibility of terrestrial chemistry, much more sophisticated chemistry. That starts to signal another sort of shift phase change, because that kind of chemistry takes place at a lot lower temperatures than the earlier states of the cosmos. And so something new emerges then. And then you get a further phase change, which is the emergence of biology. Somehow out of a warm soup of organic chemistry, the story goes, emerged life, and you get biological chemistry, biological life, with all its differences compared to the earlier phases of the cosmos, really quite a radical break. You know, perhaps that occurred about 4 billion years ago on this planet. The universe itself is 13.7 billion years old, so life is probably older than that if it exists elsewhere. But it certainly marks another phase change. And then as biology gets more complicated, you get more sophisticated animals appearing, and eventually culture, as we know it, starts to appear, and maybe even language on top of that. But these are the kind of instincts and habits which are shared by groups of animals and eventually merge into culture as we know it. And then finally, on the right-hand side there with this open-ended funnel, you have the future. And broadly speaking at the moment, the idea is that culture continues, it develops, it particularly develops technologically, and with greater technology perhaps comes all sorts of new possibilities, and who knows, maybe new phase changes as well. But the distant future of our cosmos is now generally thought to be one of gradual cooling into the almost infinite distant future, because it looks like this material cosmos is expanding and accelerating because of what's known as the dark energy. So there's something of the Big Bang story. And the thing I want to draw attention to particularly is this notion of the phase changes, how different things emerge at different points in this story that really couldn't have been anticipated before. But the consciousness big story is significantly different. I think actually this story from physics can be wrapped up into it, as I'll try and indicate. But it's broadly different because whereas this story of the Big Bang sees increasing complexity giving rise to these different phase changes and ultimately leading to a complexity that we call consciousness and self-consciousness in animal life and our life, the consciousness Big Bang story, if you like, argues that consciousness must have always already been there, because consciousness can't actually just emerge out of nothing. And that rather what happens as the story unfolds is that it's not consciousness that emerges, but greater freedom emerges. And moreover, that freedom leads to a kind of return. So let me say something more about that now. I hope you can see this new picture now. And this is going to be my way of trying to tell this story. As I say, it's a bit of an amalgam, but I hope it captures a lot of details anyway. The words I'm going to use are not completely strict. Sometimes people use different words, but I hope it gives you a sense of what the imagination and its biggest scope, its biggest expanse enables us to traverse. So this story begins with, in the Platonic tradition, it came to be called the One. And the One is a kind of all-present vitality, undifferentiated, aboriginal godhead, if you like. It's the Tao that cannot be named, perhaps. And I put it there at the top of the screen in this whiteness before anything of differentiation emerges. And we're going to move down the screen. And as we move down the screen, complexity and creativity will start to unfold, but consciousness and freedom will be lost until the return gradually. That's the broad dynamic. And the One in this story spontaneously emanates, because part of the oneness is excessiveness, is abundance, is giving. It can't, if you like, help but overflow. And maybe the first sense of that overflowing is what might be called the logos. And this is the capacity of the One to reflect on itself, to have mind, to have consciousness of itself. It might also be called the intellect. Not intellect in our rational sense, but intellect in the sense of becoming aware, of resonating. Some kind of experience, you might even say, of this oneness. And that gives rise to a third element, which we might call spirit. And this is, in a way, what's known by the One and the Logos in their beautiful exchange. And a third thing spontaneously appears, which is what's known. In the Platonic tradition, it might be the ideas or the forms. It might even at this stage be not just spirit, but the very highest angelic intelligences as well, that dance in the Christian myth, at least, right around the throne of God, the seraphim and the cherubim. But it doesn't stop there. This is a continual emanation and outpouring. And you can say, I think, that it also gives rise to Sophia in a fourth move. And this comes with a certain complexity now, which gives rise to wisdom. So it's not just knowing, not just contemplation, but a kind of almost know-how, a wisdom. The angelic intelligences that you might call powers and principalities emerge at this point, as well as Sophia herself. And you might even say this is the beginning of soul as we know it. A kind of vitality that has dynamic dynamism to it, that can find its way through things, and in particular know its way back to the divine, back to God. So these four elements are, you can imagine them in a kind of fourfold vision, mutually sharing, co-mingling might be the Blakean phrase. We're still very much in the period before time, we're in eternity here. But it gives rise to creation. It gives rise to manifesting, in a way, life or states of being beyond itself. Creation as we start to experience and know most directly. I think one manifestation of this might be matter, and it might also be pattern, that which sometimes gets called the laws of nature. The things that start to get manifest in the cosmos as we directly know it, and who knows, perhaps in an infinite number of cosmoses elsewhere as well. And this is where we kind of wrap up with the story, as physics is beginning to tell us, as to some degree at least, recognizing that we're not talking about complexity giving rise to consciousness, but nonetheless, complexity does give rise to life in its instinctual senses, first of all, and then with its co-creative senses as well. And then also perhaps even in us with its self-consciousness as well, and maybe even language, that crucial part certainly of our consciousness, sharing in the divine logos, for we humans at least, life appears. But with this also comes mortality. I mean, early life, actually, if you think about it, single cellular life in particular, which was the longest lasting life on the planet, in a way is eternal. It reproduces by division, not by sexual reproduction. And so keeps on going in that way. It's a kind of eternity, that replication. But with more sophisticated sorts of life comes death as well as sexual reproduction. Certainly as we human beings know it, relationship seems to be intimately tied with the experience of death and dying, beginnings and ends. I'll say more about that towards the end. But also with that comes a sense of ignorance, comes what in the Christian tradition might be called the fall, comes suffering as well. We're sort of moving into the darker, lower ends of the picture now. And this, though, starts to precipitate a turn. This would be Barfield's sense of the alienation of the original participation of life. But the alienation is also has its own, as it were, secret story that starts to turn about, because that alienation enables the individual and so enables a sense of awakening, a sense that there can be turning points in life, that there can be incarnation, that at least in human beings, we can know ourselves as fully human and capable of being transparent to the divine as well. And so this leads to another move, which is return. And this is the important U shape to this story. It's not linear like the Big Bang story. If you can just make out the U's that I try to indicate with those arrows. It's a return to the one, but a return with difference. So it's not just, as it were, straight back up the central line. It's a return with difference. And in particular, what you start to see is unity in diversity rather than in just the oneness. So the story here would be that as we become more and more fully ourselves, we don't actually become more and more isolated from others, but we realize our harmony, our individual dance with other things throughout the cosmos. And it's that which leads to our return. So consciousness and freedom takes on new qualities as well. It knows harmony, for example, as well as complexity and creativity, taking on this notion of unity and diversity. And so you have these wonderful mutual exchanges. Now, this perhaps we just get intimations of, and maybe it's just a few spiritual adepts, the spiritual geniuses of our times that see this more and more fully and try to communicate it and show it and transmit it to others. But this is, I think, the rather wonderful, biggest story that Owen Barfield, drawing on others. But the thing I love about Barfield is that he gives it sort of evidence in a way because of his looking at words. He saw this in the very language which we speak. He saw this transition and so he was able to connect the more immediate 3,000 years of historical life with this older story that spiritual adepts have been telling for quite some time. And there's something lovely about that because it means that our time has a particular contribution to make to this story, which I'll try and say something about now. I want to say something in a sort of more negative vein about how to discern this bigger picture. How do we know that we are focused on it, that we're understanding it, that it might be even unfolding in our own experience? And one of the ways that Barfield thought you can tell the difference between the linear story, which tends to dominate the cultural discourse, certainly in the West now, of the Big Bang, with the U-shaped story, is by what he called watching out for residues of positivism. And positivism is the broadly philosophy of modern science. And in particular, it is the philosophy that lies behind this sense of linear emergence. A more common phrase of putting it would be to watch out for spiritual materialism, which broadly speaking is the tendency to collapse what properly belongs to these wider realms of consciousness, of spirit, of which matter is a manifestation, to collapse that multidimensional picture onto the one dimension of matter and see spirit and consciousness as perhaps epiphenomena of material processes. Now, one of the ways you can tell this is going on is when people talk about the imagination as representing the world to us, rather than enabling us to become co-creators with the divine life. So Immanuel Kant, for example, in his theory of the imagination, he says that what imagination enables us to do is to kind of build up images of the world around us, but they really only exist in our own minds. And that if we're lucky, they're more or less accurate, and so give us a sense of connection to what he called the thing in itself. But we can't know the thing in itself, he said, because our imagination just gives us representations. So Barfield and Coleridge and others would say, no, that's completely wrong. The imagination, because it holds us, it's not that we have it. It does give us access to the thing in itself, and so enables us to become participants in the divine life, and in particular, to become co-creators with it. He thought that there's a tendency to psychologize the imagination as well, as if it just exists, you know, inside our own heads, or perhaps inside us as a species. And he actually critiqued Jung quite heavily at times for at times doing this. And I think in some ways Jung did do this at times. You know, Jung could speak just as a psychologist, and when he was addressing certain audiences, and particularly it was only later in his life that he himself became more expansive and gave up the psychologizing tendency. But if you hear someone say, you know, the imagination is a product of our mind or maybe our group mind, you'll know that they're suffering from spiritual materialism, this residue of positivism, and they're not attaching to the fuller story. It's wedded to progress rather than to return. And this is, again, quite a widespread idea. It's not just that we live in a civilization that's deeply wedded to progress, imagined as linear growth. But in quite a lot of psychology, even spiritual psychology, this is quite a dominant idea. Sometimes it's known as developmental theories of the self that begin with infancy, but have been extended into adult life, and in some writing can even be extended into spiritual life. And Barfield was wary of that because he thought still are hung up on progress and the linear or maybe cyclical patterns even, but they've lost or haven't regained touch with this U-shape of return, which he felt was so important. Another way that spiritual materialism creeps in is by what you might say confusing techne with telos, to use two smart sounding Greek words. Techne meaning not just technology, but the human ability to manipulate and control the world more generally, and confusing advances in that realm with the telos, the true ends, the true final participation to which we're genuinely headed. Now this pops up very overtly with, say, stories of the singularity, which is one of the stories that comes out of Silicon Valley, that broadly speaking, literal technology will one day become consciousness conscious and enable us to gain things like immortality. That Barfield would say is a form of spiritual materialism. But he even critiqued quite close fellow spirits like Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who too has a story of the evolution of consciousness and directly connects it to the divine. But he thought that de Chardin at times gets too enamored with technology in the story he tells. And in particular, de Chardin's notion of the nous sphere, a kind of technological wrap which will enable the linking of consciousness around the earth. He thought that is dangerous even, actually. And if you actually read extensively de Chardin, this can pop out sometimes because, for example, he rather celebrates what in another guise you might think of as the rape of the earth. He celebrates the extension of field and factory across the earth willy-nilly. He even celebrated the detonations of the atomic bombs because he saw in the flash of the nuclear energy an intimation of the flash of light of the divine. And that confusion, I think, is because he confused technos with telos. He confused human self-motivated power and ability with the kind of participation in divine life, which actually is about self-giving and opening, Blake's notion of self-annihilating even, which I'll say something about shortly. So watch out for these spiritual materialisms, even in seemingly spiritual discourse. And then just a final point. If you ever hear people talking about consciousness emerging, I've talked about consciousness emerging in the Big Bang story when matter gets complex enough. A quite popular idea of this that does the rounds at the minute is panpsychism. The idea that there's kind of proto-primitive aspects of consciousness, even in single atoms, that full consciousness emerges out of when atomic structures get complicated enough. Well, it's not a bad story, and maybe it's a breaking down of strict materialism, which would even deny the existence of consciousness. But it has the limitation that it doesn't appreciate, you might say, the bath of consciousness that we are born into, which in a way is shaping the whole thing, and which matter and complexity is a manifestation of, enabling the freedom of return. So watch out for those things. Does the imagination represent rather than create? Is there a psychologizing tendency? Is there an adherence to progress rather than return? A confusion of techne with telos? And then the sense that of panpsychism, again, as well, an emergent story. Now, to say more about this final participation, if we've done a little bit at least of discerning when we're kind of moving off track from the biggest story, I don't think this is unfair to Barfield to say that he himself was less clear about what final participation was about. Figures like Rudolf Steiner are a lot clearer, except that they're actually quite hard to understand for people like me, at least, anyway. So what I wanted to do was kind of gather together my best intimations, particularly from reading Barfield, as to what this final participation might be like. Barfield was very influenced by Christianity. He was a Christian of sorts. I'm not reading into him there. He saw Christ as a pivotal point in this story, the marker of redemption and the beginning of return. And in a way, the extension of the incarnation, therefore, I think must be a crucial part of this story of final participation, this end to which we're all moving in one way or another. And that means that more and more people will become conscious of the divine within and will achieve what might variously be called awakening or enlightenment, know themselves aligned more with the divine aspect of themselves rather than, say, with the mortal aspect of themselves and all the suffering that that brings. So the incarnation is a crucial indicator and pointer of the broad direction. I think it is to become not just instinctive in our consciousness, and which we certainly are at times, and when we look across the animal world, we see a lot of instinctive consciousness. It's to become co-creative, and that partly means becoming capable of introducing novelty into the world. I think the generations of animals, and maybe Darwinian evolution could be fitted in here, as one of the mechanisms that we see that brings about this novelty. But with the addendum that it's not the blind forces of Darwinian evolution, as the official story at least is, but it's the way in which, well, actually, as an evolutionist called Simon Conway Morris at Cambridge University puts it, he sees evolution as seeking and searching and enjoying, delighting in all the niches that exist in the cosmos. And those niches are not just physical niches, like, say, the sea or the sky, which the fish and the birds have exploited, but immaterial niches as well. And in particular, Conway Morris argues that there must be a moral set of niches in the cosmos, which are where the good, the beautiful, and the true can be found. And we human beings in our evolution have become good, and maybe we'll become even better at exploiting those niches. They become part of our life, quite as much as terra firma, the good, beautiful, and true. But there's a third element here, which is what you might call love, or spiritual rapport, where we don't just know our own life in its wonderful ways, but that we start to appreciate more and more the life of other creatures round and about us, other entities round and about us, other intelligences round and about us, and the divine round and about us as well. So to recall Barfield's expression again, we get to know the inside of the whole world as well as our own inside. I think this often comes about with Blake's notion of self-annihilation. And this is Blake's understanding that we must, first of all, cultivate our sense of ourselves, but at some point, and maybe for quite a long time, be simultaneously trying to overcome ourselves, so that our striving to become individuals, our striving to become human, with all the anxiety and suffering that that brings, the mix of feelings, the contraries, which the Romantics were so good on, you know, the love and the hate, that gradually that gets burnt out of us. And so that we become more and more transparent to what's good, beautiful and true. But there's no sidestepping, I don't think, the bottom of the you, the struggle with mortality, the struggle with redemption, but so that we can become not just alienated, but individuals who can self-consciously receive this grace, can step on this return. That's part of the subtlety of our journey. And I think Blake was onto this, and others have been as well. A figure that I'm increasingly interested in, actually, is the Russian philosopher Vladimir Solovyov, who Barfield wrote about as well, Solovyov. And he talked about what he called an inner apocalypse. And I like this idea because the apocalypse is normally talked about as an intervention in history by God. In Christian circles, it would be talked about as the return of Christ. But Solovyov realized that that, in a way, suffers from spiritual materialism, and that what we need to try and see more clearly is an inner apocalypse, where apocalypse, you know, means the unveiling of truth, where that gradually actually happens in our imagination, in our inner life. And that when we realize that it's already occurred, you might say, in the inner life of all things around us. You know, it's why Jesus actually said, people will say, when is the end times going to be? You know, when will the return of the Messiah? And he said to people, they will look here, they will look there. But I tell you, the kingdom of God is already within you. And that is the inner apocalypse of Solovyov. And I think Barfield can really help us flesh out what that might be about. Another element which I think is really important, which the imagination can get to grips with and a lack of imagination really struggles with, is the notion of sacrifice. And again, you see a kind of evolution of the notion of sacrifice, that it used to be thought of as an external thing, you know, originally in the sacrifice of animals, maybe even of humans in some traditions, to facilitate relating to the deities, to the gods. But with the appearance of this axial age, of which Jesus is one, you see it actually very clearly in the Hindu tradition here, in the Bhagavad Gita, where sacrifice becomes an inner gesture that the individual is invited constantly to be making. And it's receiving life and receiving your own life, living your own life, really fully making something of your own life, but constantly offering it back to the divine life from whence it came. So it's about living in the present. It's about imaginatively realizing that your life and death is actually held within a wider process, a wider life. And so sacrifice comes to be seen as this continual offering of oneself back to the divine. And it means that the storehouse of your life actually can increasingly be experienced as in the divine life itself. And so this sacrifice is expansive of yourself. You know, it's to put it another way, it's in the little deaths of the everyday, the beginnings and the ends, the little kindnesses, as Blake put it, that we experience this in one way. And when we become familiar with that in life, it means, I think, that the final death of our mortality can actually just be seen as a phase change back to the divine life. I think figures like Socrates knew this when they were writing the Phaedo. So maybe I'll just end with a couple of poetic invocations of this, because I think one of the reasons that poetry is so important is that the way it puts words together, the way it releases the soul and the inner life of words, this is very much Barfield's understanding, is that it gives us intimations and glimpses of this biggest picture of the imaginative life. Here's a few lines from Blake, from Blake's Auguries of Innocence. And auguries, of course, means the capacity prophetically to tell the future. And the word innocent for Blake after experience means returning to the divine life. So these are couplets that he put together. They're very well known, that I don't think are supposed to be read as moral couplets, as they sometimes can be. But rather they're supposed to spark our imagination and invite us to go right to that edge of our minds where we can barely know what we're hearing and yet somehow know it's the direction into which we're being called. So listen to these couplets and register how they can be moral injunctions, but then register, do they actually work on my imagination to take me to a different possibility and experience of life? Here are three of them. A robin redbreast in a cage puts all heaven in a rage. Each outcry of the hunted hare, a fibre of the brain does tear. A skylark wounded in the wing, a cherubim does cease to sing. And he very often makes links to heavenly entities, even while something is happening on earth. And I think that is the clue that these aren't just expressions of outrage against unnecessary killing, say, which is certainly so, but as it were, that outrage is seen to be based on the ignorance of life. And so when Blake says, for example, a skylark wounded in the wing, a cherubim does cease to sing, he's making the link there back to the return, to the divine life. And that's what these auguries of innocence invite us to consider. And let me just read one final quote from another poet who's really onto this in his own way and is actually a wonderful poet, quite well known. Increasingly becoming known, I hope. I like him because he's English as well, and so writes directly to our first language, I guess, for most of us, at least here this evening. It's the figure of Thomas Traherne. And here's a phrase, a passage from his Christian Ethics, which I hope captures some of what I've been saying, and I'll leave it with you before we move to questions. The sun is a glorious creature, and its beams extend to the utmost stars. By shining on them, it clothes them with light, and by its rays exciteth all their influences. It enlightens the eyes of all the creatures. It shineth in 40 kingdoms at the same time, on seas and continents in a general manner. Yet so particularly regardeth all, that every mote in the air, every grain of dust, every sand, every spire of grass, is wholly illuminated thereby, as if it did entirely shine upon that alone. Nor does it wanly illuminate all these objects in an idle manner. Its beams are operative, entering in, filling the pores of all things with spirits, and impregnate them with powers, cause all their emanations, odors, virtues, and operations. Springs, rivers, minerals, and vegetables are all perfected by the sun. All the motion, life, and sense of birds, beasts, and fishes dependeth on the same. And I hope that captures some of this wonderful vision of unity in diversity and that harmony, that freedom, which I think is the consciousness beckoning us to return.